You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Billy Tien. She's talking to me from New York. Billy, thanks so much for being with me today.
Hi, it's my pleasure.
Billy, let's begin by talking about what you're working on at the moment in terms of your architecture, and I know you're probably working on a number of projects. You have a big firm, but what's happening at the moment?
Well, I mean, I suppose the thing that has us in, I work with my husband and partner, Todd Williams, and in our studio, which is an amazing group of about 35 people, but a large part of our focus and energy right now is on the Obama Presidential Center, which will be located in Chicago on the South Side. And it's an amazing project, as you can imagine, because prior to starting our conversation, when we were talking before we started recording, we were talking about optimism. And indeed, this is very much a project based on optimism and belief in people.
That's powerful. I mean, it that of course seems to, you know, relate to Obama's presidency, which certainly at this moment seems like a very optimistic presidency. But that also is something about, as we were talking off the record before we began the interview, about the philosophy of your firm, which you wrote quite a while ago, but it was, we see architecture as an act of profound optimism. And so in the context of this, of the library, which I'd like to talk more about, how does that affect the building of it? And I kind of wonder what goes into that, because I think of, you know, it is essentially a library, isn't it? A research center?
Actually, it's not. So there was a very intentional choice made to call it the Obama Presidential Center. So, and I can go into that later as a sort of description of why it is not specifically a library, but more a center. But the idea of optimism, I think architecture is almost inherently, you have to believe in the future because you're making something for the future. And and I think we all sort of act as architects with this desire to in some way make a better future. And we've tried to focus our work of our studio on work primarily for universities, schools, nonprofits, because generally there is always a kind of an aspiration which is not focused, is not a financial aspiration. And so we've found over time that those are the ones to whom we can give our hearts.
Mm-hmm. And the center. Let's talk a little bit about the center and how that's being built and designed, as opposed to a library, which is how I think of it. And you know, of course, his presidency was also an extraordinary presidency for so many reasons. But in the context we're in now, in contrast to the current one, you know, it also. I was thinking recently, as my son asked, like, why was Kennedy remembered so much as this kind of extraordinary president? And that brings to mind the Kennedy Center, which I don't think is quite the same thing. But is there parallels? And the question is essentially, why a center and what is its function?
Well, there are really a number of reasons. But the first and foremost reason is that he and she want this center to be a place for helping people understand how they can engage in a civic life, how you can help to shape your present and your future, and the importance of people's stories and how people can come together and and make change. So presidential libraries or museums have always had a kind of trajectory where they're first visited when they open by many people, and generally, as time goes on and presidents become memories, they have less and less visitation. So the idea is that there will, of course, be a museum, and as the first African-American president, of course, there will be, you know, people have the desire to honor this. So it will be a very visited museum. But the archives, which are often, which have been traditionally part of a presidential library and really why they call it a library, are going to be digitized. And part of that has to do with the fact that, of course, he was really the first president in a digital era. So it's not as if they're banker's boxes full of papers the way there might have been in a previous administration. But also it's a way of certainly making at least those things that aren't classified available to more people. And if you've ever been to a presidential library, and we visited a number of them, the actual archives are not things that the public is allowed to go into. So if you call ahead and you're a scholar and you have credentials and you can show, you know, the foundation what you're doing, then you're allowed to make an appointment to go into the archives. But and I didn't know that when I went to the Bush Library in Texas, and you know, I started walking down hallway and a guard said, "Wait a minute, where are you going?" And I said, "Well, I saw that there were the archives down here." And he said, "Well, you can't go there." So the idea is that, you know, things from the archives will come to the museum and will be displayed, but the bulk of the archives will be stored off-site, and as I said, digitized. And actually, in its place, there will be a branch of the Chicago Public Library. And as well, there will be program rooms. And so this is where people from the neighborhood, nationally and globally, will come to learn about civic engagement. So they're essentially a series of classrooms. There'll be a teaching kitchen. There will be studios where people can learn how to do podcasts, to think about broadcasting. There will be an auditorium for performances. There will be a productive garden. So the idea is that it will be as much focused on the present and the future as it is on the past. And that's why it's a center and not a library, because I think the whole idea is about the presidential center being present and forward focused.
I love that. That certainly does sound like what I love most about Obama. It seems almost an activist quality. I mean, if it's not too much of a stretch, it seems almost in comparison that the previous presidential centers, buildings, libraries are kind of mausoleums in comparison. This is a building that's meant to be used and activated and to have a social impact in the future, it sounds like.
No, that's absolutely true. And beyond that, it's interesting because it's located quite close to where Michelle Obama grew up. And it's in a park on the south side. And it will it was the site of the Columbia World Fair Exposition. So it's been a site that has been changed a lot over time. It's a park that was part of a system of parks that was designed by Olmsted and Vaux, but has changed and changed and changed again. And generally it's been, although a used park in that it's along Lake Michigan, it's not a particularly well-used park. So the Presidential Center will be a campus rather than one giant building because we wanted it to feel more accessible and open. And the topography or the landscape of the park will actually, there are one tall building and essentially two lower buildings. And the landscape will flow over the top of the lower building. So you'll be able to walk on top of the buildings in a landscape and not necessarily realize that you're on top of the lower buildings. And what that will do, we're working with Michael Van Valkenburg, who's a great landscape architect, and it will create a topography in the hillsides in what was a very flat park. So it will be, if we still have snow, it will be a sledding hill. It will give you viewpoints from which you can actually see Lake Michigan. And what we're also doing is removing a six-lane, very, very busy at times, actually, and empty at times, highway that sort of was put through the middle of the park in the 60s. So it's also trying to do something that will help revitalize the neighborhood. The South Side is a very interesting place, which is, it's not to say that the South Side doesn't already have its own vital culture, but it will allow people to more easily access the park without having to cross the six-lane highway to get to the water. So a lot of what we're trying to do is, in a way, remediate the public space, because one of the things that's very important to us and to this idea of, I guess, kind of optimism is the importance of space that is democratic, space that is open to all. And when you think about it, as we become more and more privatized, the last sort of standing democratic spaces where everybody is allowed to go and to enter are public parks and public libraries. So we feel that that's part of the sort of ethos that is certainly something that we've always tried to operate with and is certainly something that the Obamas have presented as sort of the kind of public face. And it's actually also their private face because they are truly remarkable people. And he's a very astute critic of architecture. So that's been an interesting dialogue as well.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. So in this process, as you talk to, Barack Obama about what's happening, he also is having a hand in how obviously he chose your firm, but mm-hmm. has a hand in the dialogue of the use of the goal, of the purpose. It seems to me that would be both challenging and exciting to work with a client like him who also has opinions about architecture.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been very, very interesting. So he's very involved in the design. And, as an architect, you get these clients who start out by saying, oh, well, if I wasn't a blank, I would have been an architect. And so he actually said, well, if I hadn't done what I've done, I would have been an architect. And you go, oh, usually when you hear that, you go, uh-oh. But his aesthetic judgment is very spot on, very thoughtful, as you would expect it to be.
And before we move on to another project, you said this site has been gone through many iterations, and one was an Olmsted Design Park, and are some of those things, how do you incorporate those things into it, or is it kind of like starting all over again? I mean, you're removing that huge road, I don't know if there's anything left of what Olmsted initially designed, but is there any references to that, or is it kind of a clean slate?
Well, I think many of the trees are being preserved, and essentially the parts of the park which are historic parts are being also conserved and preserved. But we're also making change, and so that has caused some controversy among people that are preservationists. And it's interesting because when you read about what Olmsted wrote, he was quite an amazing, multi-talented person who had many, many different kinds of roles during his life. But he talks about the actual sort of sculpting of a landscape to make it a place for people. And as New Yorkers, we live with Central Park. And that is a very, although it looks natural, it's a very, very sculpted and changed landscape. So I think, I mean, we are doing about 19 acres of a very much larger park. So I think what is happening is that there is a kind of both acknowledgement and reverence for Olmsted. We're saving what we can save. And at the same time, we are, I think, working very much in the spirit of Olmsted, which is making it a better place for the public.
And let's talk about one more project before we go. I don't know if you have a favorite one you want to discuss. I was thinking of the Lefrak Center, but is there something else that you think was a particularly exciting project that you've done in the last several years that we could touch on?
Well, I do and like the Lefrak Center. It's an ice skating rink. And I guess one of the things that we feel very committed to in the work is to try to do work that is going back to this idea of a democratic space. And so it's in Prospect Park, which is an Olmsted and Vaux Park, and is a rink that is used for two rinks, actually, that are connected by a kind of little canal. So in the wintertime, it's skating, so there's a kind of hockey rink, and then it's connected by a kind of ice canal to something which is an oval, which is free skating, which is outdoors. The ice skating, the hockey rink is under a roof, a covered roof, but it's outdoors. And in the summertime, it's open as a water play and roller skating. And in many ways, it was a model for the Presidential Center, because these are also low buildings in a park that have the landscape coming up over the top of them. But one of the other things that is also what happened there is it was an area of the park that was less taken care of, and now it's much more used. And there are public bathrooms that are part of it and a cafe. So it becomes a kind of amenity for a larger group of people than used to be there before. So I enjoy it because there's nothing more fun than making an architectural project and seeing it be used by kids, even though a lot of the kids are falling down. It's pretty amazing how little kids can run around either on roller skates or ice skates and take amazing falls and pop back up again. So, I mean, it's quite joyous in that way. I mean, we have other more serious projects which are, you know, focused on art and art museums, but usually there's more decorum. So it's kind of fun to have one where there's just only joy, not so many.
I love that. And as you were saying, it has some similarities into how you're using the the land and the profile of the buildings, because this was also has a very low profile, is that similar with the center also that you're building now?
Right. And, you know, one of the things when you go on in the hockey rink, which is a regulation hockey rink and used by a lot of different teams, is the underside of the roof is a dark sort of sky blue. And there are silver marks in it, which came from a design when we were looking at the marks that people make in the ice when they're doing figure skating. So there's something about the project that is both quiet and settled in the land, because the land comes over it, but there's also something that feels like a surprise and an amazement. And certainly that's what we hope to bring to all of our work. I think generally our work from the outside is first quiet, and then once you get to know it or you find yourself inside, there are things that you don't expect.
And I love that you described that, because I saw that in the images and wasn't sure what it was. So that dark blue ceiling that has those marks in it, is that mm-hmm. also integrated with the lighting in the ceiling? Because those marks, of course, are very, you know, there's a pattern to them that we can probably all picture, whoever's listening mm-hmm. to this, and I can picture them now, but they're also quite... you know, unstructured in a sense. So just to talk about that ceiling a little more, because that's a beautiful touch. Besides that color and those marks, is that kind of painted on the ceiling, or is that part of the lighting? How is that ceiling put together?
So as architects, you have to be both artistic and practical. I mean, I went actually to art schools when I first started out. So one of the things about that I found frustrating about art school is that you sort of had to figure out your own problem, and then you had to solve it yourself, and then you had to decide whether you did a good job or not. Architecture asks that you still work with artistry, but that you solve somebody else's problem and that you have to be very practical. So we had this idea of making the ceiling that would be like what you might see on the ice. And so our first thought was, we'll make these carving marks in the ceiling, and the ceiling will be dark blue because you want to look up and imagine you're seeing the sky or the firmament, and that we would use these marks as a way of lighting the ice. It turned out that it was too expensive to light it that way, we needed to light it in a much more normal way, because when you're playing ice hockey, you need a consistent level of light at the ice level.
Right.
So instead, we realized that when you cut marks into the ceiling and you paint them silver, actually when you shine light from the ceiling in a standard way using light fixtures down to the ice is a giant reflector. It's like a big white lamp. So the light from the regular lights shines down onto the ice, and it bounces back and illuminates the silver marks that we cut into the dark blue. And all of that is about a way of trying to make magic, but trying to do it in a way that is low-tech and simple. And I think, that's what's happening with the ceiling.
I love that. That's such a beautiful image and idea and process. It sounds just lovely. I have to go see it now and ice skate there this winter, I suppose.
And
let me ask you this. Yeah, with my son. Let me ask you the last question, which is, what are you reading at the moment? I'm always curious what everyone's reading.
Well, I'm a voracious reader. In a way, I grew up in a suburb, extremely shy, the only Asian family in the suburb in New Jersey, and I just enter the world through books. So I actually only read fiction. I never read about architecture, but I find the world through fiction. So I just finished reading a kind of amazing book called Ohio by a writer named Stephen Markley, and I think it's his first book. And it's about a group of, I guess maybe they're in their 30s, people who, for one reason or another, come back to their hometown in Ohio. I really also love books that have many, the sort of generational books, or many, many people coming together. But it was so interesting to me because I read Hillbilly Elegy and it really annoyed me because it was so much of the sort of persona of the writer. But at the same time, I was trying to think, you know, I admit I live in a bubble. I live in New York. So I was reading, you know, as if I were going to, sounds terrible, but, you know, to a place that I don't visit very often, not a foreign country, but like a place where, that I know is outside my bubble. And when I read Ohio, it's very much about a working class, or even a city that used to be working class. It is having, you know, issues with drugs, with industry leaving. And it was an extremely powerful book, which for the first time made me feel like I had some sense of, you know, what people, both the sort of anger, fear, and also the sort of solace that people feel living in this particular town. It was the first time I ever had a sense of the kind of brotherhood of combat, because one of these people is a young soldier who's returned from Iraq. And understanding why people would sort of go back and sign up again and sign up again, because it's a kind of intense but incredibly connected world when you're fighting together. So completely took me out of where I am. And actually, that's what I'm always looking for fiction to do for me. It is my wall. Since I work live with a person who, you know, so work and life are totally intertwined for me. When I hold up my book in front of my face, it's my sign that says, no longer here, not present to talk about architecture now.
I like that. Billy, I want to thank you so much for talking to me today. It's really been a pleasure talking about your work with your husband.
My pleasure too, as I said in the beginning. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.